Andrew Byrne is here, our vet. He's going to pop in now because I know you want to ask him a question. Andrew, could you pop in, please? Because June wants to ask you a question. If you wouldn't mind, it'd be very much appreciated because you love your animals, don't you? I'm also told that you love a bargain and that you're seeing
traipsing
from shop to shop.
I love bargains. When I go to London, how you doing?
Hello.
How are you? When I go to London, I love to get an old bargain. Well, even in Dublin as well. I love going down to Mead Street because the atmosphere down there is fantastic. So you have a good bit of crack down there, as the fellow says.
What do you want to ask Andrew? He's all yours.
Hi Andrew, how are you? I just wanted to ask you, I don't know, every year I see this, and I don't know, is it a thing that maybe the vets, you know the way the vets write every year out to, you know, their clients about, you know, things that the dogs need to get done?
Yeah, this injection, that injection,
But could it be added, the likes of, because I see it in the park every day and I see it out on the road, the amount of people who tie their dog onto the back of a bike.
Mm. Well, actually, funny you should say that. I saw a woman not so much bringing a dog for a walk last night as bringing the dog for a drag.
Yeah.
Getting the dog across the road. And it did strike me that she was dragging the dog across the road. For some reason, the dog didn't want to cross the road.
Yeah. And I just think in the heat that we've had, because I told you before about my dog, and it was my own ignorance that caused it, was I had it down in the park. It wasn't even a really hot day. I threw the ball. She was a black Labrador. And next of all, her back legs went. And the vet told me if I was 3 minutes late, she was dead. Heat exhaustion.
Yeah, that's very important because it takes you by surprise. And we see that every year, even in Ireland, because it is warm enough for heat exhaustion. Yeah. And it's a killer. They can die from it and die very quickly.
Yeah.
And the classic is if they're in the car, you know, with windows closed on a sunny day. But it can happen just exercising. If a dog's out running and exerting itself a lot on a warm day, it's possible for it to get hypothermia. And that can cause seizures and eventually can
I suppose be like us running around with a fur coat on us with no water. You know, now one thing he did say to me, and it's something that I do every day, when I go to the park, I actually bring a bottle of iced water with me. Because he did say to me, there's no point giving it room temperature because, you know, they've got so hot that room temperature won't bring their temperature down. They need really ice water to bring the temperature down.
Yeah. And what you can do very simply, if you bring a bottle of water with you and pour it over the dog.
Yes.
As well as giving it a drink, you just pour it down their back, just on the top of the back before you start the walk. And then as it evaporates, because dogs can't sweat, horses and humans can sweat, but dogs can't. They're relying on their tongue to evaporate moisture off the tongue to cool down. And if it's a warm day and they're exercising a lot, sometimes they just can't cool down quick enough. If you wet the coat as it evaporates, that keeps them cool. So certainly during the summer, we do that with our dog now. During the summer, we'll actually just pour some water over before we take her for a walk.
Really, yeah.
And then
I don't think people mean to be cruel. I just don't think they think. You know, they go out jogging and they've this little King Charles, which a lot of King Charles do, you know, have heart problems and that kind of thing. And they don't think they go jogging. Because I know a girl who went jogging with a little King Charles and it just dropped dead on her. And she was devastated, but she just didn't think, you know, that this little thing couldn't keep up with her.
You've got to be careful. I mean, there are some dogs and some breeds who can quite safely go running with their owners and enjoy it. But you do have to be careful about realising, looking at the size of the dog, the size of their legs, just realising how much work they have to do to keep up with you. So they've got to be young and not overweight and fit.
Yeah.
And you have got to be careful about what type of lead you're using if you're jogging with them. Because you know, if you've got a collar around the neck and you're jogging and anything happens that you slow down or speed up, then it's going to hurt their neck. So you need to look and see whether you need to use a harness.
Yeah.
Some people who jog, who take the dogs, use a kind of a bungee cord on the lead, so there's a little bit of a give in it. But I say you have got to be careful, and jogging is fine for some dogs and they can enjoy it, but they've got to be fit enough, no more than ourselves.
Well, the lucky thing is I don't do the jogging anymore, as you can see. I don't need to. You know
but
what I mean?
The dog.
No, but I bring them out every day, but I see it every day. And I have actually gone over to a few people with a bottle of water to say, could I
thirst is something we're going to talk about today and how dangerous it is. It's a warning sign, thirsty. Don't let the dog get too thirsty, do you, Andrew?
Yeah, no, it's important they have plenty of water to drink. And of course, it's also important to recognise if they're unusually thirsty, because that can be a symptom of some fairly serious diseases. And I guess normal in dogs in warm weather or they're exercising a lot, it's normal for them to drink a bit extra. But if a dog is drinking extra all the time, then that can be symptomatic of a lot of diseases.
Mm.
Of course, there's a link, it might sound obvious, but there's a link between water in, water out. So what you have to keep an eye on is how much water your dog is passing and how much water your dog is drinking.
We'll pick it up after news headlines now with Eileen Dunn. Now, back to our vet, Andrew Byrne, and you're talking about thirst, and it can be a sign of something else wrong other than the fact that the dog is actually thirsty.
It can, and if we think about the tummy or the abdomen of the dog and all of the main organs inside the tummy, like the kidneys, the liver, the pancreas, the adrenal glands, all of those main organs, if they have something wrong with them, it can manifest as increased thirst. So it's something to watch out for is the amount of water that your dog is drinking and also the amount of urine they're passing and the frequency that they're passing. People often ask us, what's the difference between incontinence and passing too much urine? How would you know at home? And the difference that you can tell is dogs who are incontinent, which is where they're just leaking urine but not producing too much, what you tend to find is little wet patches at home where the dog's been lying down. So when they're asleep in the bed, they get up and they leave a little wet patch. Mm-hmm. Or if the incontinence is worse, you might see a little bit of dribbling of urine along the floor. They're unaware of it. On the other hand, if they're passing too much urine, which is what we're looking out for in conjunction with thirst, what you'll find is they're asking to go out to the garden more often than they used to be. They might spend and squat for longer than they used to, and occasionally they might get caught by surprise and not make it to the door and leave a pool of urine. So if you notice those changes in behaviour, either they're wetting with large pools of water in the house when they used to be very clean, or they're asking to go out, or they're waking you up at night time to go out and go to the toilet, which they haven't done before, that can be an indicator that they're producing too much urine.
I just had a flashback when you said that to our little dog at home. Right. Actually doing that, not quite making it to the door, and the dog looking really embarrassed.
Yeah. They do, yeah, because I mean they want to be clean. They know they shouldn't be urinating in the house, and they do actually look embarrassed, and they get quite stressed by it. So if you're seeing those changes coupled with an increase in thirst, so if they're, and it's okay if they come home and walk on a hot day and they have a big drink of water, and then they go back to drinking normally, it's okay. But if you're noting a persistent increase in thirst, they're constantly emptying the bowl and looking for more water, that's a warning sign, and that needs to be investigated. And it can be investigated very simply, either urine tests or blood tests, sometimes both. And the four big common diseases we look for is, firstly, will be diabetes. And dogs can get diabetes in the same ways people can. And some of the risk factors are the same. Dogs who are overweight are more likely to get diabetes than dogs who are not overweight. And it's treated the same. Dogs, usually the form of diabetes that they get is nearly always the insulin-dependent diabetes. And it can be treated quite successfully. We would have quite a number of dogs in the practice who are diabetics, and they have insulin injections every day, and they otherwise lead a perfectly normal life. So it's completely treatable. The other common ailment we'll be looking at will be kidney function. And particularly in older dogs, kidney disease can sometimes manifest itself. One of the first signs very often is drinking a little bit too much. And with kidney disease, while one can't reverse the changes that are there, there are things you can do to slow down the progress of the kidney disease and also to relieve the symptoms that are associated with it. And some of those things are relatively simple, like ensuring that they do drink enough. With kidney disease, although the symptom is drinking too much, you don't want to stop them from drinking too much, because it's very important that they don't become dehydrated. Mm-hmm. So making sure they have adequate access to water. And sometimes that's as simple as having more than one water bowl. Sometimes older dogs...
In different places.
Mm-hmm. They're just too tired or too stiff to get up and go and have a drink of water. So you put bowls down in different places, so they're constant access to water. You can also make changes to diet that will help dogs who have kidney disease. And people who have kidney disease will be careful about what they eat. There's certain foods, certain things you have to have in moderation, because your kidneys can't deal with it anymore. Foods that are high in potassium, for example, or foods that are too high in protein, put extra pressure on your kidneys if they're not working properly. And there are commercial diets made now for dogs who have kidney disease. So you can use special diets that are formulated for kidney disease. And there's medication as well. There are medication that tablets that can help improve the blood flow to the ailing kidney. There's some things, unfortunately, we can't do. Like in humans, obviously, you can go many stages further. You can do kidney transplants. You can have dialysis. We don't have that technology available.
Why not?
Cost, really, will be the major factor. There have been some kidney transplants done in small animals in the States. But to do a kidney transplant, the technology involved in dialysis, first of all, if you need a kidney transplant, then it's going to be a period of time before the transplant when you'd be on dialysis. And if you look at the human situation, the cost of maintaining a patient on kidney dialysis is enormous. Mm. And, you know, to take an animal or a human, I don't know what it costs in a human to go all the way through dialysis for a year and a transplant. But I think you're talking in terms of hundreds of thousands of pounds. And the technology to do the same in animals will be the same. So it
and then really again, you have to wait for a suitable donor, even in an animal, I suppose, do you?
You do, and say they do.
Or is it less complicated?
Yeah, well, it's ethically complicated. They do it in the States.
Did you say it's ethically complicated?
Yeah, well, in the States, they do kidney transplants in some centres in the States, and it is very controversial as to whether that's going a step too far.
Tell me they're not breeding dogs for organ transplantation.
No, well, that was a danger.
Because that would be,
yeah, that would be
unethical, wouldn't it? That would be a problem.
That was a danger, and there are some schemes in the States where they people will take an animal from an animal sanctuary to act as a live donor, but then have to undertake then to home and look after that animal for its life. And there's two, that's debated as to how ethical that is. Some people will argue, well, it's good because the animal who's the donor then otherwise might have been put to sleep if it didn't have a home and it gets mm-hmm. looked after and there's a contract to look after them for life and it's a good thing. And others say, well, no, because the animal isn't in a position to give permission to have its kidney taken. Therefore, you know, are you on the boundaries of ethics? And that debate is ongoing in the States. But the way they've got around it is that they absolutely do not breed for donors. But if a person has a donor, if it's not a friend's animal who donates, if it's from a sanctuary, they must look after it for the rest of its life. And they have to enter into a contract to do that. There are very few centres in the States that do renal transplants, very, very few. But
we don't do it here at all.
It's not done anywhere in Europe, to my knowledge. And I really don't see it on the horizon, really because of the cost, because there would be enormous cost in setting up a centre that would be able to handle that. So we have to focus on the palliative management of kidney disease and doing all the things that we can do to slow down the progress of the condition.
So if a dog is presented to you and it has kidney disease and kidney failure is on the horizon and from your years of expertise, you know, this is the way it's going and it's only going one way and that's it, and there's no possibility of a transplant, you let the animal live till the end? Would it not be
the kind thing to do
to euthanize that animal there and then or within a week or two and let the family get used to the fact that this animal is going to die and we can solve this problem sooner than later and let not the animal suffer?
Yeah, well, the decision on euthanasia is always at a time when the quality of life is judged to be not good enough to be able to live comfortably.
Yeah, but a dog wants to run around and jump up and lick you on the face and fetch the ball for you.
I suppose that when you've got an animal, you don't want it to, you know, you love this animal. So, and it's just very hard to make that decision.
So are you being cruel then?
Well, you probably are, but you're being, I suppose you're... You know, it's because you love the dog that you want it to be there. You want it to be there always because you love this little thing that you've had for 12, 14 years, you know. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of people do take the advice of the vet when he says...
Did you ever have to do it?
I have, yeah.
When?
I had to do it a few years ago with my black Labrador. She got cancer and they tried everything they possibly could. And I was absolutely heartbroken. Any animal that dies on me, I'm heartbroken. It's just you get so attached to them. I don't know how you do the job you do, because I would spend the whole time bawling my head off, you know, because I'm a softy anyway. But it must be very hard, you know, for you to deal with people as well coming in, because this is a loss. This is a family member to them.
Yeah, but how long did your dog have the cancer for?
She had the cancer for a few months, but the vet had said that they're going to try this and that and the other, and there was a 90%. I went by what the vet said. Mm. But it didn't work, you know, and I felt at the end afterwards, I thought maybe I should have called it. Maybe I should have called it, because I felt that she wasn't, she was doing really well. And then.
But what kind of cancer did the dog have?
It was just from petting her. We noticed she had a lump just in her neck. And she was a beautiful Labrador. She was only 7.
Was there surgery involved and all that kind of stuff?
Well, they had to do biopsies and all that kind of stuff, but she was on chemotherapy and everything.
Is that a sensible thing to do, Andrew, to give an animal chemotherapy when it has cancer?
It depends on the cancer. I mean, the amount of chemotherapy that's used in animals is used very, very seldom. There's just a small number of tumours where chemotherapy can be used effectively and without side effects.
What's the success rate, do you know?
It varies on with each tumour, and we have access to very good data that's collated from mainly from tertiary referral centres around Europe and North America, like vet schools, and a bit like in human medicine now in oncology, where there's very good data that gives us good up-to-date statistics on the survival times, the mean survival times with various cancers, and the mean survival times with and without chemotherapy, and comparing one chemotherapy to another. Now, there's absolutely not the range of chemotherapy available for animals as there is in people, and there are guidelines in terms of what chemotherapy you're allowed to use, you know, and particularly in terms of the side effects that the chemotherapy might have. I suppose in veterinary, to some extent, from a welfare point of view, we're lucky because we have both palliative care and we have the option of euthanasia. So we can give palliative care where we can relieve the symptoms and allow the animal to continue to live in comfort.
But until also it dies.
Until we judge that its quality of life is not
okay,
sufficient.
And then it's euthanasia.
And then we have the option of euthanasia, so we're not in a position where we have to continue palliative care indefinitely, regardless of how the animal is.
And all you need
is,
to do
is
that
feeling.
Is the owner's permission? Or can you override the owner's permission and say, listen,
well,
I'm sorry, I can't let this animal suffer any longer. I know you love it, it's a family member, but look.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been in a situation where we can't override an owner's decision.
Okay,
it is always the owner's decision. I mean, our role as a vet is to be the independent, objective voice. Because as June is saying, when it's your own pet, it's very difficult to be objective because you love them so much and you never want to let them go. So we have to be able to stand back and make a very, if you like, cold, objective decision and advice. So we can only advise an owner when we think euthanasia is indicated. But over the years, I'd have to say, I don't think I've ever been in a situation where an owner has continued beyond a point where we've advised euthanasia. Mm. Now, somebody might not be able to make the decision right now, this minute.
Yes,
you mustn't pressurise somebody. You know, if you have to wait a couple of days for somebody to talk to the family, get used to the idea, you know, you mustn't rush the decision. But owners, when they realise that nothing else can be done and that they're uncomfortable, always agree to the decision. So you never have to force the issue.
How can I say this without it sounding the way it's going to sound? I'm just going to say it. So have you ever had an animal that was presented to you that had cancer? And did you administer chemotherapy or did you think, look, this isn't going to work? I've looked at my nose. Like, there's a huge expense involved in that as well for the owners, isn't there?
There is. Well, the types of chemo that we're using wouldn't be that expensive. You know, in human oncology, you could be talking hundreds of thousands for treatment. We're not using those sort of drugs. We do administer chemotherapy in the practice, and we not very often, but we'd have a small number of cases each year.
Has it ever worked?
Yes. Well, now you look at what the expectation is, because chemotherapy is not always curative. Chemotherapy very often is extending life or extending quality of life.
But does it extend quality of life?
It does.
For the time you're undergoing the chemotherapy as the animal, are you still bounding about the place? Or are you kind of just lying in the corner feeling pretty miserable?
No. If you were, then you would have to question the decision to go on, and then you would discuss euthanasia. But chemotherapy can extend the amount of life and the quality of life during that period of time. Before you start chemotherapy, you've got to decide very carefully, is the tumour that you're dealing with likely to respond to chemotherapy? And again, you see, what you do is you consult the data and you look at the statistical evidence that's there. So it's an evidence-based decision. And you consult with the owner, explain to the owner what the tumour type is, how the animal's going to feel, how long it's likely to live without chemotherapy, how long likely it's to live with chemotherapy. And you only continue
do
chemotherapy.
Do you say this chemotherapy is not curative? There has been no evidence to suggest that this chemotherapy I'm going to administer now will not save this animal's life. It will only prolong it for another year.
Absolutely.
You do say that?
Oh, absolutely.
And
every case.
And owners still say, okay, we'll do it?
Yeah. The owner has to make an informed
I wouldn't have to admit it. I don't think I would anyway. Yeah. I think I'd be inclined to say, no, please let the animal die.
But probably should say, in balance with treatment, you mentioned the surgery earlier. In most tumours, the treatment of choice is surgical. Now, with surgical treatment of tumours, when you treat them early enough, surgery is often curative. And so with tumours, it's easy to think that all cancers are not curable. In fact, actually, most cancers are curable if you can treat them surgically. And as a generalisation, surgery can often be curative. Chemotherapy is nearly always not curative, but extending life. And that's a discussion, an open discussion you have to have with an owner. And there are some chemotherapies actually can extend life and quality of life for a long time. Some they can only extend it for a very short time. But the key with tumours is that with all cancers is diagnosis, identifying what is the cancer. And that's done by biopsy, as June is mentioning, with your own dog. Mm. You can collect a biopsy from the tumour. Then you know what the tumour type is. Now you've got information. And you can explain to the owner what the disease is and exactly what the evidence would say about the treatment. And if it's a tumour that's in one place that hasn't spread, that you can remove surgically, then you can cure it. And particularly with surface tumours, that's what we tend to do. You biopsy them early, remove them early, and you have a cure. And so surgery is always the first choice of treatment. Chemotherapy is only reserved for those tumours which either you can't treat surgically or you have removed them surgically and you're trying to reduce the risk of them coming back. But the number of tumours that we treat with chemotherapy is a very small percentage. There's only a very limited number of tumours. I would say in the whole year we probably don't treat more than maybe six dogs that are practiced with chemotherapy. So it's never a decision that's taken very lightly. And it's only in limited circumstances that you do it.
Yeah, it's just
you miss your little Labrador still.
Oh well,
did you get a replacement?
I did. I had to go down to West Cork to get another black lab. Beauty, we have her, and I had a golden lab. We had to get her put down last year. She was 15, you know. She was family, you know. So heartbroken, I couldn't talk to her for about 2 weeks. Peter and I just sat there bawling our heads out. Now I've got a little terrier, a little gurrier, Poppy, and she probably won't cost us half the amount of money because the pedigrees, you know, Labradors cost a lot of money, you know what I mean? So the little terrier now is she's the leader in the house, that's it.
So you have a terrier and a Labrador?
And a Labrador, a black lab.
And are they good company for each other?
Oh, they're great. Because when Polly had to be put asleep, you know, Beauty would have been lost without her. And that happened when Jessie died with Polly.
How long did you leave it before you introduced a new pet?
Well, we got Poppy before, Poppy before Polly was put asleep.
So she was brought into the family.
She was part of the family. Actually, Andrea Smith, who writes for the Indo, she had five, because she's a great animal lover. It was her dog that met the dog next door and it all, and it all happened, and she ended up with five pups, and she didn't want to get rid of any of them, but she gave me one of them, and that's Poppy. I have Poppy now, and she kept the other, and she gave two away, and she kept the rest of them. I think Andre has about six dogs. She's great. She takes all these rescue dogs. There's so many good people out there that look after dogs, you know.
It's so true what you say about them being a part of the family.
They're a huge part.
And it's great actually that you can describe how upsetting it is when you do lose them, because a lot of people feel guilty about expressing that, and people maybe who don't own pets sometimes don't realise how important they are in the family and how upset we all are when we lose
absolutely
them.
Absolutely heartbroken. I know of a friend of mine who's a member of our family. They had to get their dog put to sleep yesterday, and they're just devastated by it because this is a huge part. This is a bit of company. You know, you walk into the house is empty, and this little bundle of fluff is going to show you all the affection, you know, that you need, you know. You know, a lot of people actually prefer their animals to some family members.
they don't judge us. Yeah.
Did you bury the dog in the back garden?
What?
Did you bury the dogs, the back garden?
Yeah,
you
did, yeah.
Did you have a little ceremony and everything?
No, well, I have a little stone that is like a little, it's like a little dog that is actually just lying down. I saw it in one of these garden centres, just a small little thing just to have. I have it up at the back of the house, but it was amazing when Jessie died and we buried her, that Polly would not go down the garden. It was just weird. It was like as if she knew. She must have known, but she would not. And I had to get my friend Jean and her two dogs to come up to get her two dogs to walk down the garden so she'd follow them down.
Tell me, did you dig the grave yourself?
Peter did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you covered it over yourself then as well?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That must have been hard.
It's really hard.
You know, it's one
terrible
thing saying goodbye to somebody or your pet.
Yeah.
But to dig their grave and then cover it up, that's another thing altogether, isn't it?
That's very difficult.
That's why we've got grave diggers. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. No, it's. But then you've got some comfort that she's there with you, that you haven't just given her somewhere else, you know, that you have her there, you know, which I know it's different strokes for different folks.
But it clearly means a lot to you, June. I can see it in your face. Hi, Derek and Co. Great show today. What a super individual June Rogers is. We are so used to hearing her alter ego, and she comes across as a very kind, caring, compassionate individual. What a super mum June would have made, says Julie. Well, that's nice to hear that. We put all your love into your pets and animals.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick phone call and then a break, Andrew. Somebody wants to say hello to you. She'll be waiting for a while. I think it's Natalie in County Meath. Natalie, go ahead.
Hiya, Derek. Thanks very much.
No, thank you.
Andrew, basically, I have a Cavalier King Charles. He's 4 years of age, and he has been diagnosed with having a skin allergy, a skin condition, in which he was scratching himself really intensely, and he had been persistently licking his paws and all of that. So we had to get blood tests sent across to England, and that is what came back. And so he's been on steroids ever since, and he takes one steroid every day. But he, I suppose as a side effect of that, his hair has kind of started coming out, and it's gotten a lot lighter on one side. And I've heard just from word of mouth, not from a vet in particular, just from word of mouth, that omega-3 or omega-6 fish oils can be quite good for their skins. And I was just wondering, is that true? And is there a particular dog brand, or is it just any human normal fish oils that you can use?
Yes, Natty, you're correct. The omega-3s and omega-6s are beneficial to the skin and coat quality. They're also beneficial to joints as well. And there are specific ones made for dogs, which you could get at your vet's. They do some in a joint formula and some in a skin formula. It just, the only difference is really the amount of omega-3s and the ratio of one to the other in the product. So they certainly are very useful as a nutritional supplement when there is skin disease. Skin allergies are always frustrating because it's a condition that doesn't go away, and it's a condition that you don't cure as such. You're having to control the symptoms. Steroids would be the most commonly used drug in treating skin diseases, and some dogs respond very, very well to them, and some dogs tolerate them very well. Then you get some individuals that either don't respond or don't tolerate them as well. And you could have a chat with your vet if you're concerned about the tolerance for the drug. So there are other therapies that can be tried. And I suppose skin treatment of long-term allergies can really fall into two categories. And sometimes you use it two categories of treatment at the same time. There's drug therapies that reduce the response of the immune system to reduce the itchiness in the skin. And prednisolone is a common steroid that's used for that. But there are other immune modulating drugs that can be used as well. There's also immunotherapy, which is successful in about 60% of cases. And immunotherapy is where you firstly identify the allergens if you can with blood tests. I say if you can because identifying the allergens is not 100% accurate. But there are blood tests that will help identify the allergens. And if you can identify the allergens, you can make up a vaccine-like product which you inject into the dog on a regular basis once a month to try and desensitize the immune system and to try and untrain it from overreacting to the skin. And I'd say about 60% of dogs can respond to varying degrees to that. And sometimes it eliminates the need for drugs, and sometimes it'll reduce the amount of drugs that you need to use. So have a chat with your vet about there are alternative treatments that you can try. But in the meantime, certainly the omega-3s and omega-6s are helpful. They won't cure it, but they will help the skin quality.
Thanks, Natalie. Just 1 minute left. Peter has been on to say that he's got an 8-year-old female fox terrier who pees when she gets excited. Any tips? How can we resolve the problem?
Well, yeah, that's quite common. Sometimes when they just are excited, they can do that. It's usually not a problem. They tend to do it when they're young, and then usually as they get a bit older, that tends to stop. Very often happens when somebody rings the doorbell and they run down the hall, get excited and pee. So if it's associated with people calling at the door, maybe just keep them in a room.
Sorry,
at June, the back
used
of the
to
house
do that as
for
well.
A while.
But go on anyway, yeah.
Still
yeah,
doing
if,
it.
If you can, this is very difficult to do, but if you can slow down their excitement, in other words, if you can
How
sort
do you
of
slow down the excitement.
Yeah, if you say when the doorbell rings, not let them in the hall straight away, you know, leave them in the back room or the kitchen until you open the door and let the person in. And then they hear them coming here and they hear the sounds. And so the excitement tends to subside a little bit. And then you bring the person in and introduce it to them. But it's a common problem with young dogs, and usually they grow out of it. And it's usually not incontinence.
Eight years old.
Yeah, well, that's a bit unusual, yeah.
So go to the vet.
Maybe go to the vet just in case there's more to that than just the normal excitement.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much indeed. June, thank you. Best of luck at the Tala Fest. Good to see you again. Yeah, glad to bring you together. We should get you together to do a program. That's two telly. We're making a telly program with you and Sil Fox and Noel Viginity and the rest.
Brilliant. And I would do a vet one as well.
A vet program with, yeah.
Great.
To stop you getting excited every time somebody rings the door.
I could be the nurse. No.
Well, a wet nurse. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.